the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
How's everybody doing tonight? Good? All right. Who's, I want to ask now, we're going to revisit this later, but does anybody have a birthday tonight? That many people?
Some on top, too.
Oh, just like, if you have a birthday, just say, like, just do one noise. Really? We need five of you, but it sounds like there's tons more. Okay, let's do some introductions first, so we know, and then we're gonna get started. We're gonna talk about I have a lot of anecdotes I want to share, and I talked about these last night, but we didn't record it, so I get to talk about them again. Is a lot of anecdotes about you people drinking too much. First introductions.
Giannis Patelis from Meat Eater.
My name is Jesse Griffiths.
Talk up your deal. Talk up your restaurants, man.
I have a couple of restaurants in Austin. Dai Due and Dai Due Taqueria. Cheering for Austin or me? Also run a business called New School of Traditional Cookery, where we incorporate kind of a culinary aspect into hunting and fishing, offer three-day trips, custom trips, stuff like that. Also wrote a cookbook called A Field, Wild Game and Fish Cookbook.
All right.
Hi, guys. I am Danielle. Wild and Whole, so I am the girl who cuts up hearts and tells you how to cook it.
Hey, everybody. My name is Carl Malcolm. I'm the regional wildlife ecologist for the Forest Service based out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And my whole career is rooted in the fact that I love to hunt and fish. That's what motivated me to become a wildlife scientist.
And this is Carl's eighth.
That's right.
Eighth appearance on the show.
Yeah, it's an honor, man. I appreciate it.
And Carl pointed out that not only has Johnny Cash been on this stage, but also Groucho Marx.
We're walking in the footsteps of legends.
In the footsteps of legends. So I was going to talk about, but I decided not to because we already talked about it a bunch. How in Houston, a woman went into, this just happened, a woman goes in to smoke a joint. You guys know this story? In an abandoned house, and there's a tiger hanging out in there in a cage. That's like the most Texas thing I've ever heard. This guy I worked with, Brody, we were rounding up things to, like, just some local flavor, and Brody stumbles into this.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, go ahead.
It's a little late, but is that what they mean by high fence?
No. It's all that Texas high fence they're always talking about. So, the guy we work with, Brody, rounds up this, like, it's like a roundup of game warden activities from around the state, and, so a game warden in Van Zandt County. Two game wardens in Van Zandt County. Are you from Van Zandt County? If I hit on something, any of the people, if you people are in these stories, please come to the stage. So you get a picture of game wardens, right? They're out trying to catch poachers and stuff. These game wardens in Van Zandt County are going down the road, and they come across a vehicle stopped in the middle of the road. So they question the people. And there's a person who's too drunk to explain where they live, which is making it hard for their designated driver to get them home. The designated driver, turns out, has been drinking. So the game wardens arrest the designated driver, and the dude who can't figure out where he lives somehow has it in him to call another buddy to come pick him up. That buddy shows up, and he too is arrested for drinking and driving. And so, moving down to I keep messing this up. The Z one, how do you say it?
Which
Z
one?
County?
Zapata.
Zapata.
Yeah, you guys from there? So
nobody.
Here, a game warden responds to a tip about an illegal gill net in the Rio Grande. Goes down there on the Texas side of the river and starts pulling out some monofilament gill net, which has been set illegally. And by the time he's done, he has hauled in 4,000 feet of gill net. Near Abilene, a game warden sees people shooting from a truck, stops them to ask them what's going on, and they explain that they're multitasking because one of the things they're doing is they're drinking. One of the things they're doing is the woman, her and her boyfriend are drinking, and they're teaching her son how to drive, and they're hunting hogs. In Bexar County, which I made the mistake last night, I called it Bexar County. Bexar, which didn't go over well. Bexar County, game wardens find a guy on social media bragging up about how he's been doing a lot of hunting and fishing in the San Antonio power plant property, which is closed to said activities. And they want to find the guy, so they review his social media posts and eventually figure out who he is and learn that he's on felony probation. So they can't find him, so they just go down and wait for him when he needs to show up for his probation court hearing and then arrest him. Another Texas news story that's interesting is red wolves. So red wolves, I'm trusting you to know a little bit about this, Carl. Red wolves have been declared extinct.
In the wild. Yep.
And they've tried captive breeding.
They have.
On an island off of North Carolina.
They have tried some, yeah, but there's no red wolves alive in the wild.
Yeah, and they were just surprised to learn that on Galveston Island, the coyotes there carry red wolf genetics.
Yeah, and quite a bit of it. Yes, like to the point where, based on the most recent genetic analyses, they have more similarity to the red wolves than they do to a pure-blooded coyote.
Yeah.
So they're kind of a middle ground, which raises some interesting questions about what defines a species, really.
Yes. What do you think? Can Texans start worrying about how they have wolves, or is that premature?
Oh, there's probably plenty of that chatter already.
Yeah. Another thing, again, the second time I talk about this, but you guys have... This is the one it's hard for me to pronounce. You know the animal I'm going to say. The Nilgai.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Now, you also have a problem in Texas with the cattle fever tick. Not the tick that makes you that you can't eat meat, but like a tick that spreads a disease, cattle fever. And they can eradicate it in cattle or can control it in cattle, but now the Nilgai carry the tick. So they are installing motion-activated spray machines that are like trail cams, but they blast Nilgai with a solution containing nematodes that kill the ticks, which would be some unnerving shit to happen to you. Right? To be like walking through the woods and all of a sudden, I would be distressed for a minute.
Well, you know when they zap them.
What's that?
You know how they zap them and
no,
when they
zap
them?
No, I have no idea. I haven't looked into it.
So the trick is, Nilgai are very wide-ranging species, like compared to a white-tailed deer, they cover a ton more ground. But they congregate at shared latrines.
Oh,
so they're
right?
Installing these things at the shared latrines where all the Nilgai will get together and do their business.
So it's like even more unnerving.
It's
like a bidet
toilet. Yeah. So you show up to do your business, and then you end up getting sprayed.
Is that really right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, now we have two genuine Texans. Have you guys hunted and eaten?
I've hunted Nilgai. We've actually done a lot of stuff. I was just down in the King a couple weeks ago. I had a bunch of clients. I was cooking for clients that were hunting nilgai. And it's true. You'll see an 8-foot circle of nilgai shit in a road.
Do they like to mound it up?
It's mostly flat. I'd say it's like a hill or a dale of shit.
Yeah. Because, you know, llamas, like if my brother keeps his llamas out in a flat, like if you keep them out in a flat pasture, llamas like to any kind of little rise to get on. And they'll shit in the same spot and build a little looking like a little pitcher's mound that like becomes substantial, and then they'll perch up on there just to get a better look.
Oh.
But the meat, the nilgai meat is good.
It's fantastic. Even the bigger bulls, I mean, they get huge. I mean, 600-700 pounds plus, not unheard of. And in my experience, even the big bulls are really good to eat.
Is that right?
What would you compare it to?
It's maybe axis deer, like very mild, maybe less, has like less of an iron flavor than whitetail, little bit beefy. It's really, I mean, very lean, but very, very good.
It's good stuff. Yeah. We wanted to touch real quick on the Frisco coyote epidemic.
Everybody lives in Frisco.
Yanni's a subject matter expert on the Frisco coyote epidemic. Break it down.
Sounds like all of you must have been bit by a coyote in the last 6 months from what I read. what else I know about them? They're chewing on small dogs, cats. I think even one news source had come up with their own app to report coyote sightings. And at the time, there was over 300 coyote sightings right around Frisco. And people were genuinely worried. Yeah.
Because like 5 people, right, got nipped or bit?
I think it was 7.
Seven people got bit?
Yeah.
Do you guys live in Frisco? Oh, have you guys been bit?
No.
So everybody's doing. Are you cool on that subject? Like that's kind of the extent of it.
Yeah, you know, it didn't surprise me really when I read it. I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
We have.
You have something to add?
No.
Oh, you're not cooking coyotes yet.
I'm good.
Died away. No.
But I mean,
I want to give a quick shout out. Another podcast guest, Bracey V. Hill II, is here with his friend Wes Keys. Wes runs Wild Game. Am I saying this right, Wes? Wild Game for West Dallas. They put together 2,000 pounds of venison for protein poor neighbors. Processors. There's a group called Hunters for Hungry. So people, deer hunters are bringing deer down to processors. Hunters for Hungry are paying for all the processing fees. And then they also have a group, Brother Bill's Helping Hand, and they've been teaching, they've taken some young kids out and doing their first hunting trips. And he's here in the crowd tonight, so I wanted to mention that. He mentions that we need to have more Doug Dern. And I think that the world needs more Doug Dern. Quick question. Yeah, we were with him the other night. Okay, one more person I got to bring up. There's some guy here, Joel, with the wife who has the coolest name in the world named Timber. You guys here? Okay, wedding advice. Wants wedding advice. Well, he wants us to explain, Timber. I don't know if I'm doing this. Joel wants us to explain I'm just going to come at it, that you need to make sure that he's allowed to go hunting all the time. He wanted us. I was supposed to frame that up as some kind of marriage, be sly and frame it up as some kind of marriage advice, but that's just what he's getting at. So I'm just going to cut right.
I've got an angle for it, because it sounds like maybe he's not getting to go enough, right? Or he feels that way, right?
No.
No?
Because now you're going to make it that he's not going to have a good night. No. This dude says, I go all the time. I think that he wants to just make sure that continues.
Oh.
into the future. Precedent, like precedent setting, which is, that's a big, that's my marriage advice. My marriage advice starts before you get married.
If I was Timber, I would even push him. And because there's this like yet to be the guy that actually hunts 365 days a year. So I would say when it's been about 8 days or 9 days in a row, if he actually hunts that much, that when he's like, so I'm going to sleep in tomorrow morning, I'd have that alarm going off at four and be like, dude, get out of bed and bring home the bacon, bro. Like, no rest for the guy that wants to hunt all the time, right? Like, get it. And just kind of see where that levels out.
He's getting married in May, so good luck to him. Now, digging in. We're going to focus pretty heavy, not like totally heavy, but pretty heavy on wild game tonight because we got so many good cooks up front here. We got some other questions. We're going to stray a little bit. We're going to touch on cannibalism. I want to talk. I got a question about whether deer ever lose their ability to get it up, which is for Carl. But first, not like that, man. I don't mean you're gonna know because you know
subject matter expert.
I mean like you know because it's like an animal question that I was gonna steer your direction.
I knew what you meant.
But first, I want to get into this one. This is a question that comes in. That came in. It's that this is a panel opportunity. What have you eaten that you will never eat again, and how was it that you cooked it? I can start or I can go later. It doesn't matter to me.
You got one?
I got one. And staying on brand, I'm a big fan of hogs. I ate a hog once that had been snared. And that thing had been in the snare for at least 2 hours
okay.
by the time we got up to her. So, I mean, enough that when I walked up, she just lost all the, you know, ability to fight. I just got really sad in here. she had just given up. But that meat was absolutely inedible. So I hung up the hog snares after that.
Really? I have some of those, and I look at them all the time. I've never messed with them.
I mean, for eradication, it'd be good, but for pork chops, not good.
Really? What do you got, Giannis?
I don't know if anything that really fits that bill, because I want to try it again, and this might be a good segue for you, but merganser, a hooded one. The one time
we... Merganser?
Yeah, the one time we tried it, it just, we stunk out the apartment and just vowed to never do it again. But now
with the skin on it,
I can't remember. I doubt it. I bet we just took the breasts out.
But you don't mind Goldeneye?
No. But I just remember this was a long time ago. This is probably close to 2 decades ago, and I remember it being pretty fishy.
Fishy.
Yeah. Livery.
The thing I made, this is kind of like what I made is like it's intertwined with the how you cooked it. But I wrote about this in my first book, and I always remember just how kind of off-putting it was kidney pudding with elk kidney, but it was from an old elk. And the fact that, like, when you're eating it, and it really, honestly, it's like eating, like, solidified piss. And, man, that was just, like, such a letdown, you know?
Like a urinal cake.
What's that?
A urinal cake.
It was like a urinal cake. You've eaten one of those?
No, those like soapy things in a urinal.
Yeah, it'd be like if you cooked that.
I've not eaten one.
But it was, yeah, it was like a, you know, you cook it and it kind of rises. It has like a souffle-ish kind of thing. But man, it was not a good dish. Kidney pudding. You ever got burned on a dish?
Yeah. This is actually really embarrassing, but in my early days of cooking wild game, actually probably my first experience ever processing, butchering a deer, it was a gift given to us by a friend who had manages ranch, and he quartered a deer. And I was like, we're going to process this whole thing ourselves. And what should have taken like hours was like days, because I thought all I knew was like get all the silver skin off. So I'm like breaking down the shanks, like I'm going crazy. So like days this meat has been in the cooler, and I don't know that you should drain the water out and keep fresh ice in. So it's like nicely marinating in this cooler for way too long.
In its own goo.
Yeah. And so I have all the bones left, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to make a stock. I was just like hot shot in the kitchen at this point in time. So I start making the stock. I wake up early, roast the bones. Like, it's just, I got this nice pot going, and I like realize it smells really bad. And I'm thinking to myself, well, it's just gamey, right? That's just like venison. I'd never really worked with venison before. I'm like, it's just gamey. It'll get better. Just keep cooking it. And like, it's on the stove for hours. And then Travis, that's my husband, Travis comes home and he busts the door open and he yells at me like, why are you making a European mount in the house? Like, do that outside. Like, yeah. And I was like, okay, this is not right. This is. So I threw it out. So I didn't try it. But the worst thing, so I didn't even taste it, try it. It was like death in the house. It was so, so bad. But the worst thing I actually ate was a tundra swan that had been in a Ziploc bag, or not even like a Ziploc freezer, just like a little baggie in the back of someone's freezer for a couple of years. I had like a nice freezer burn, like as if tundra swan wasn't, you know, bad enough. It was.
So they have so much tundra swan laying around that they lose track of it.
Travis went on a hunt with a buddy in the pothole region. This was up in North Dakota, not Texas. Up in the pothole region, and they were diver duck hunting, and they see some swans come by, and they start yelling, "Hoo ha, hoo ha!" They turn around, so he gets his swan and. I actually wanted it mounted, and I didn't, but I wanted to eat it. So his friend's like, oh, I have some in the freezer. You can mount that, and I'll give you this one. So I was like, oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
But no good.
It was terrible.
You got, Carl, something in China?
I ate some bad stuff in China, for sure, but the thousand-year egg, no bueno.
Have you eaten that deal, the embryonic, you know what I'm talking about? You ever eat those? Where they let a duck egg? Balut. Yeah, I've eaten that. My God, man.
Yeah. That fits into the category. But the thing that came to mind, first of all, is stuff that I now love eating, but at the time had no idea how to handle it. And so I've been thinking lately, you know, like, anybody out there grab a copy of the new Fish and Game cookbook?
There it is.
So the reason that that's cool is I think about being like a 13-year-old squirrel hunter who loved hunting squirrels and didn't know what the heck to do with them, really, and how it would just be a different ball game today to have the videos, the cookbooks, and have all that at your disposal as a new hunter. But to answer your question, when I was learning how to hunt, we'd do these like Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett adventures where we'd go camping in the woods behind our house and we'd catch trout, we'd pick mushrooms, we'd hunt squirrels and grouse, and pretty much whatever hunting success we had, we'd build a fire, skin out whatever critter it was, and just like hold it in the fire. And so you'd get this like black, crisp exterior,
raw in the middle,
and bite in, and it would be like cool to the touch on your teeth.
Yeah.
And you'd be like pulling meat off. You'd be like, I must really like hunting. So I'm done with that. Like, I'm doing all kinds of, you know, like squirrel now is the bomb.
Yeah,
but it's because I've learned how to do it. And, you know, that's one of the things about having these resources at your fingertips now. Like, we weren't jumping on YouTube or jumping on your smartphone. It's like, here's a dead squirrel. I'm going to build a fire and hold it in there, and it's going to be awful.
That's like a long time ago, that was wild game cooking was so weird because I often think, like, the impact of phones you don't even really think about is that you used to, if you're going to meet your friends, you guys all had to pick a bar, and no one could leave the bar to go to a different bar because you wouldn't be able to find each other, right? You had to, like, pre-phones, everything was different, man.
Yeah.
It was hard to find people.
You're starting to sound like an old man.
Well, yeah, but you know what I'm saying? Like, if you remember, it was very difficult to like locate your buddies. You could lose track of your buddies without phones. But also, yeah, you couldn't look up how to cook stuff. So we would just know that people ate something. Like, we knew, I remember the first time we tried to cook a deer tongue was in 1994. And we just knew that it was a thing one could do. But we didn't have access to even the idea that the skin's supposed to come off.
Yeah.
So we'd boil those sons of bitches and try to chew on them and boil them and try to chew on them. Because, and now you just would very quickly just realize, you know.
Yeah.
But we would just, in like trying to figure out how to cook beaver tails, when you have, it's just a thing, you know it happens, but you don't know how to do it, and there's no, you can't convey the information.
Yeah.
Unless you stumbled across some weird old cookbook somewhere, you just had no way of knowing. Now everybody knows everything. Now when people don't know how to do something, I kind of look down on them a little bit. It's like, just look it up, man. A dish guy asked about, oh no, first I'm going to get to this, Carl. I got two more, because we're going to use you up right now.
Okay.
Two questions.
Okay.
Which one do you want first? The grizzly bear one or the penile erectile dysfunction in deer one?
Penile one.
Okay. A guy wants to know, because here's where this is coming from. Here's where this is coming from. There's a guy, I can't remember what state he's in. There's a guy and he hunts a property and there's a really old deer and the landowner's like, don't mess with that deer. Ever. But he's wondering, is it ever that, because he thinks he wants this old deer that's got big antlers to breed and make more deer. And he's wondering, do deer hit the autumn of their life, right? Like dudes who, there's a long period of a dude's life when he's not breeding anything, even if he wanted to. So is that known? Like, does a deer age out or do they stay viable till the bitter end?
They do not age out.
They don't age out.
And nor do the females, for that matter. And if you think about, so there's this myth, right, of like...
The old dry doe.
Okay. And there have been numerous research papers. A deer biologist by the name of Glenn Delgades did a great study up in Minnesota where he was looking at fecundity, the ability and basically rates of pregnancy and number of offspring across different age classes of females. And it just keeps ticking up. Like, older does tend to be more fertile than younger does, but fertility rates are very high in females. And given the complexity of what the female reproductive system has to do compared to the male reproductive system, there's a lot more that, you know, can go wrong, essentially, in terms of having those years of fertility. That's why, you know, a woman has a relatively narrow period of fertility compared to a man. But in deer, if you think about the fact that they have this narrow breeding season, and you think about the fact that, you know, most of these bucks are dying from sources of mortality other than aging out, the likelihood of any individual deer getting to the point where they're not performing reproductively, it's just not going to happen. The exception would be if a deer experiences some kind of an injury. Like, people have probably heard of the term, like, cactus bucks.
Yeah.
Bucks that'll get some damage. They'll injure their testicles, those sorts of things.
You better explain a cactus buck.
So a cactus buck would be a deer that essentially keeps growing layers of velvet that are never shed. And the growth, like, the antler cycle is controlled by sex hormones, testosterone. The seasonality of breeding is what is linked to antler growth. So post-breeding season, when the testosterone levels start to drop, that's when the antlers would fall off. But in a deer that has experienced an injury to its testicles, or perhaps has undistended testicles, they'll just keep growing layers of velvet, potentially, on their antlers and get these really funky antler configurations and sometimes just carry velvet antlers for a long time. But there is an example...
Well, I have to know what she just said.
That makes sense.
Oh.
There is an example.
Good job.
Thanks, man. There is an example of erectile dysfunction in the wildlife kingdom, though, that I think would be of interest to people. So, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, are precipitating out of the atmosphere near the poles. And this is having a disproportionate effect on animals that are at the top of the food chain. And as you go north, we're talking polar bears here. And there was a research paper published recently about the fact that these PCBs have
is
the
that
potential.
What they're telling you is not in your water bottle? No,
yes.
That's BPA.
Really? Well, there's a few things they're telling you are not in the bottle, but yeah, there are estrogenic substances in some plastics that they're really worried about when it comes to drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
But PCBs are a byproduct of manufacturing processes. So the problem is they can weaken skeletal tissue, bones, including in polar bears. Like they're detecting weakening of polar bear bones. And polar bears are one of the species that have a very unique bone.
Baculum.
The baculum.
Pecker bone.
So there is concern that PCBs have the potential to weaken the penis bones of polar bears to the point that polar bear males could be predisposed to breaking their penile bones, thereby experiencing high rates of what would effectively be erectile dysfunction and further compromising their state, which is, you know, being driven by climate change and a host of other factors. But in the world of ED, in the animal kingdom, that's the best I can do for you.
Man, that's good, though. That's good.
I want to give an excellent answer.
I can't decide if we should give... No, I'm going to ask you the other one. I got my other wildlife question. One I can't... I have a good sense of what it is, but I can't figure out. So
okay. We
all know, like, when you look at European contact, we had, you know, mountain lions coast to coast, top to bottom. We had wolves coast to coast, top to bottom. Why was it that the grizzly bear never colonized the eastern U.S.? What kept the grizzly bear stuck at around the big bend of the Missouri River?
You want a real short answer?
Yeah, tight. No?
Short answer? The short answer is habitat.
Open country.
Open country is the grizzly's preferred habitat. And if you'll allow just a couple additional details, if you go back in the evolutionary tree, you have a common ancestor about 1 million years ago that was shared by black bears and brown bears. And at that point in time, you had the differentiation where, due in part to the habitat provided by the glaciers receding, you had all this open country. And you had some of the bears specialize in hunting and living in that open country, and some of the bears specialize in occupying the forested habitats. And that difference in their habitat preference has driven so much about the morphology, the behavior, the level of aggression, the reproduction, everything about the life histories of brown bears versus black bears is driven by black bears being specialized to occupy densely forested habitats.
Yeah, like a quick example would be the short hooked claws
that
allow a black bear to climb a tree.
Yeah.
And the grizzly's long claws, which are great for digging, but make him incapable of climbing a tree.
But there's so many more cool details than that, the more you start to think about it. And furthermore, that specialization for open country and just being able to hunt the wide open and be very protective and territorial over your offspring and being just like a bad mofo kind of bear extended even further when the grizzly differentiated into the polar bear later on in its evolution. So if you think about the extreme example of that open country, untreed environment, the polar bear is like the extreme version of that. And that's a relatively recent split in the phylogenetic tree. But everything about reproduction, like American black bears, their offspring stay with them for the first year and a half. Why is that? Well, a year and a half old American black bear can flee up a tree if it encounters danger. In contrast to a grizzly bear, where the offspring stay with the mother for 2.5 years, and that's thought to be, in large part, because they remain so dependent on their mother for protection that if they were to split at 1.5 years, they'd end up getting smoked by another bear.
They can't get away.
They can't get away. So yeah, there are places, obviously, we could come up with a list of all the places where brown bears and black bears coexist, where they overlap, where you've got some forested habitat, but that's always going to be a place where you've got forested conditions for the black bear and proximity to open country for the brown bear. So the brown bear is an open country species compared to the black bear.
I'm tracking. Good.
There you go.
I want to move on to, we touched on this now, and I want to move on to cannibalism real quick. A guy wrote in, and he was talking about that his buddy, he's talking about a guy. So there's a guy saying that another guy is going to get liposuction. And he's wondering, can you use the fat for anything? And you remember that in Fight, yeah, I was going to talk, in Fight Club, like part of the plot is that they're using human fat to make soap. And a dude once sent me, I don't know if you guys have done this, a dude sent me fat that he's been making with black bear.
Soap, you mean?
Sorry. Sent me soap made out of black bear fat. It's not really about cannibalism, but have you guys messed with this at all? Like making your own, any kind of soaps out of fat? Bear fat, deer fat?
I've never made it, but we actually at the restaurant, we sell soap made out of wild boar fat.
You do? Really? And it works pretty good? I mean, it makes you clean feeling? You
come over here and...
Come over and check it out. Yeah, have we talked about this? That you've the only guy I know that has, you've kind of cannibalized.
Kind of, yeah.
Because you've eaten human placenta.
I don't have a tattoo yet that says cannibal.
Yeah, you've eaten human placenta.
Mm-hmm.
And you've drank.
So I've done it twice.
You've drank mother's milk. Drank human milk.
Well, yeah. A lot of us have drank human milk.
You drinking human milk? No, yeah. You're right. You know what? That's a good point, man. But I mean, like, that's a really good point. But he drank it as a grown-up.
And yeah, you start to think about, but most of us who have consumed milk, it's from our own mother. But then there are all these examples in a lot of cultures, including, you know, in some communities in America where it's commonplace for babies to be passed around to various lactating moms, and whose milk it is isn't
like
that big
nurses.
Of a deal. Yeah. And then you start thinking about the milk banks where you have mom A giving mom B's kid milk, and milk's just like flowing all over the place.
Yeah, my wife would give out frozen sacks of milk to friends of hers for babies, though. What do you guys get for what do you get for a bar of hog soap?
It's like $7-$9, I think.
It's pretty nice stuff.
Yeah, it's got juniper berries in it. It's really nice. Good cover scent too. If you're hunting pigs.
You have any experience with this making?
No, I thought about doing something with the deer fat because it's so waxy. I was like, that could seal a lot of things up.
We used to seal boots with deer fat. We would take deer fat, and man, it makes your boots stink, man. But we would just melt deer fat down and rub it into the leather. And I used to have a buddy who, this guy named Leighton Waglenda, and he would take bear fat and pine pitch and beeswax and make his own triple blend boot stuff. The hard thing to get was the bees. Like, he would track the bees to their hive and then take a chainsaw and root out all the, you know, root out the beeswax and make the boot stuff. That was kind of his scene. Now, we want to touch on, because we're going to talk about Davy Crockett for a minute. Because can you explain, Danielle, what you were telling me about what he might be credited with?
No, I was trying to tell you that it was a lie.
Oh, the Hush Puppies was a lie?
Yeah.
Oh, that,
yeah.
She fooled you.
You did fool me. Because we're going to play a game.
I win.
We're going to play a lie. So that was trying out a lie?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Was it a good one?
But was it true about the bear killing the Daniel?
Allegedly he wrote that he killed 105 bears in Tennessee.
Bars.
105 in 7 months, and I think either 42 or 47. I think 47 was in 1 month.
In 1 month.
47 bears in 1 month.
Yeah, because Boone claimed, Daniel Boone, and like people lump in Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, but different dudes, different times. Like not the same guy. Daniel Boone was 1,000 times cooler than Davy Crockett, which is offensive to Texans. But you guys, listen. Are you guys aware that it is rumored, right? Are you guys aware that it's rumored that Crockett I hope his family's not here. The Crockett did not go down in a blaze of glory.
Oh, no.
I said it's rumored. You're familiar with this?
I mean, we've seen the footage. He tossed that torch into the gunpowder room, and he took out like 100 Mexican soldiers. And he shot Santa Ana's hat off of his head at 1,000 yards.
You've seen the photos, and no. But are you aware of the myth, like the competing legends about Crockett?
No.
A hotly contested.
You're gonna have a meeting here soon. If you're not careful.
I was telling Giannis this story, and I got the story all wrong. But then we looked up the true version. There's a hotly contested journal. You look like you're agitated.
I'm just trying to speak for everybody here. Carry on.
A hotly contested journal. Like, the veracity of the journal has been called into question. But there's a journal that exists. I think it sits here in Texas. I think it sits in the state capitol or something. You guys already know all this? And it was that at the end of the smoke clears at the Alamo, and Crockett had surrendered and was executed. And I don't have a dog in the fight here. I'm just saying that this is a contested thing. And Danielle got to tell me how Davy Crockett invented the hush puppy, but it was which I thought was true.
I can't believe you thought that was true.
I don't know why I thought it was true. Thought that, but like, so you know, we have like Boone and Crockett, like they've been stuck in our heads together. Boone and Crockett. Boone claims to have. I wrote it down here because I've quoted this 1,000 times, but I don't want to mess it up. Boone claimed he killed when he was hunting bears for the bacon market and the lard market. He killed 155 in a single fall and once killed 11 before breakfast. Hunting with hounds. They would get, I think, like a buck a gallon for bear fat. Whoa. And they would cure the hams. They would tap maples for sugar. They would go to salt licks and boil down the water to make salt, and they would make their own salt sugar brine. They would brine the bear meat in barrels. Make their own smokehouse, smoke it, and then haul it on keelboats to be sold. And it's plausible that, like, and this is contemporaneous with Benjamin Franklin. So it's, like, plausible that Ben Franklin ate some, you know, bear meat from some long-haired wild man out running around brining bear meat. But you imagine 155 in a single season, and we were talking about like all these animals that used to exist across continent, and we kind of like whittled them down to next to nothing. That's the kind of feller that
did some whittling.
Yeah. And you think about how cool they are, but you also think like, what is their sense of like give me the numbers on Crockett.
147 1 month.
47 bear. Like, what is their sense of enough?
That's like Timbers, dude. He hunts that much. He could probably kill 47 in 1 month.
Yeah, presentism. Okay, I want to move on. There's a guy, I think he's here tonight. He is here tonight. His name's Stephen, P.H. Stephen. He has a great sentence in his letter. My name is Stephen. I'm a big fan and a lazy Texas hunter. He goes on to talk about, and this is good. I don't know the answer to this, but I'm curious. Everybody's all hot on hot pots. What do you call them?
Instapots.
Instapots. But he's like, why is it when you make something, if you cook game in an Instapot, it just is never as good as if you slow cook it straight up? I want to think about that while I make sure that this is what he's saying. Does that sound right? Are you here? Yeah. You're buying. Like, I'm doing a good job with your question. Is that yes or no? Good. Okay. Yeah. So he's saying, what's up with Instapots? I've never messed with the Instapot. I do have an electric pressure cooker, but it's not called that.
I would just get, I mean, there's really no substitution for time, especially when you're breaking down silver, you know, getting marrow out of bones. You need that collagen to gelatin conversion. You need that, just that texture, that flavor that's going to develop over time. And it's, you know, it's, microwave's not going to do it, and some fancy Instapot contraption's probably not going to do it either.
I think one of the biggest issues, so I started looking into the differences between electric versus manual, and the biggest thing with Instapot is, like, obviously convenience. So you kind of like, I've never actually used one, but I've read through recipes and instructions from Instapot, and you put the meat in there and it's supposed to brown and sear the meat, and then you add your liquids and everything, and there's just, it's just steaming. You don't get that like Maillard reaction of brown, like a true browning your meat. Yeah. You're just steaming it, and so you really lose a lot of rich flavors by doing that. And plus, like you were saying, like, you don't have time on your side either.
Well, I was thinking too, it's like the, there's no escape of water, right?
Right.
So there's no reduction happening.
Well, because it's pressurized, the theory, or I guess science behind it, is that it has nowhere to go, so it goes back inside the meat with all that pressure in there.
Yeah, I got
so,
it.
I mean, I use a manual pressure cooker quite a bit, and I like it a lot, but it is not the same as, say, braising in the oven. It's not the same result, but that's, you're using it for convenience factor. So when you're working and you have a busy schedule and you want some thigh meats to be really tender in a really fast time, it's convenient, but you just aren't going to get the same depth of flavor if you were to slowly do it in the oven.
Or a crock pot, for that matter. I mean, I'm a big fan of browning something in a pan, transfer that to the crock pot.
Yeah.
Let it go for 6-8 hours, however long it needs. But you get the same kind of thing. But I think you just have to have that time in there. And like you're saying, the browning process.
Yeah.
So important.
Go ahead, Yas. Available everywhere. Everywhere books are sold.
I feel like I even get two separate results between crock pot and, say, Dutch oven inside the oven. Would you agree with that as well? And have a thought on why that is?
You can have more radiant heat from the metal versus just kind of that light ambient heat from the crock pot, I think. You know, the metal is just going to conduct a lot more. I mean, Dutch ovens are amazing, too. I'm a big fan.
But right.
Yeah, I think, and plus it's just cast iron. It's just more authentic, and sometimes your brain just wants that.
Yeah, right. So it might be a little bit of placebo.
I think that in a Dutch oven, in the oven's the best.
Because like,
what else gives you that like caramel coating that's a real bitch to clean off?
That
radiant. When you see that, man, you know you've made something, you know?
Yeah.
But my suggestion on the Instapots would be like cooking stock in there. Like a really good stock that you pour in there, because then you're sort of given, you're taking time earned from somewhere else and applying it.
Yeah. I would say if you're going to use an Instapot, or any kind, even a pressure cooker or a crock pot, brown it separately on the pan first, always, and then combine everything.
Saute in
an Instapot. Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is, like, that's not like a real saute pan.
This guy's a representative from Instapot.
you close the lid on that and you're steaming it. You're not letting any of that moisture evaporate, so you lose.
Oh, you can leave the lid off.
Leave the lid, but here's the thing. No, I don't want to get in a big fight. We already got in a fight about Davy Crockett. But the one, like, I have one that's not that brand, and it's a deep ass thing, and it's like, it's searing in there is not the same.
Still not the same.
Still not the same. Okay, I want to move on to one thing real quick here. No, this is not quick. This is a long one. I'm going out of my own order. You are, Jesse, you've been described as did you describe yourself as an adult onset, late onset hunter?
Yes.
What happened?
Well, I'd fished all my life. I mean, I grew up in Denton, which is just north of here.
Sock a leg.
There you go. I'd fished Lake Ray Roberts and growing up. I was actually, I remember when they filled that reservoir, and just came to hunting later on in life. And I worked in restaurants since I was legally old enough to work, and then learned to butcher first, and then went into hunting after I learned how to butcher animals.
You started working in restaurants real young?
Mm-hmm. 16.
Doing what? Washing dishes and whatnot?
Everything. I've washed dishes, bartended, waited tables, worked in the kitchen.
And what got you? So what was the butchering? The move into butchering. What'd that look like?
I eventually became a butcher at a restaurant. We were getting whole animals in. This is almost about 18 years ago, and back when people were just starting to get back into whole animal butchery. And this restaurant I was working in started bringing in hogs and lamb, and we just learned to cut them. And then after that, I was able to kind of make a pretty, you know, easy segue into hunting, because the back end of it was super familiar to me.
Yeah.
There's a lot to learn on the front end of it. But
what was your awareness? You grew up in Texas, so there's a huge hunting culture in Texas. What was your awareness of hunting, and what were your perceptions? Did you have an opinion about it? You didn't have an opinion about it?
I was always curious about it, but my family, I'm only child. My dad didn't hunt, but like I said, we fished constantly. And so I just had to get out there and learn myself. And, finally did, and then it took. And then there was something to do in the winter, besides fishing in the warmer months. And so now I find myself constantly occupied. So.
Yeah. And then you eventually got to where you cook a lot of game in restaurants.
Right.
And in your own places. Talk about the pet, because I think a lot of people around the country, people here are familiar with it, but a lot of people around the country are really surprised to hear that actual wild pigs make their way into the restaurant world.
Yeah, it's a complicated process, though. We get all the time people, somebody will roll up to the restaurant and knock on the back door and be like, "Hey, I got a pig out here." And I'm like, "No."
You don't touch that?
Yes, no, totally illegal. It has to be inspected. So all the hogs that we get in are trapped. They're trapped mostly out in the hill country. And then they're brought into a licensed processor in a trailer. And then he kills them. They're inspected before they're killed. They're inspected after they're killed. They're blue stamped. They got a nice little Texas symbol on them. Stamped and then brought to us from there.
But that pig could have trichinosis. No one tested for that, right?
Sure, but so could a domestic pig. It's highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is. There's swine brucellosis, pseudorabies, tularemia. There's a host of things that they are for hosts of. We keep our eye on it. Texas Animal Health Commission, kind of updates everyone on cases, and then it's pretty rare to see anything come from the feral hogs, although they can be vectors for a lot of different diseases.
Yeah, over 90% of the trichinosis cases in this country come from black bear meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember in Alaska, they had a guy that got it from walrus, which really surprised me. Then you guys also, so you do venison too.
We do.
But that's the weird one when I wanted to ask you about, and I told you I was going to ask you about it. It would be if you have a restaurant that sells wild game, right? And people have an idea what that is. And when you sell wild pigs, that conforms to wild game, where here's this animal that no one has any control over. It leads its own destiny, right? It just kind of does its own thing, cruises around out in the woods. But when you sell the venison, that's not like, that's like a farm animal.
No, it's not necessarily. A lot of them will come off of really large ranches, have a ton of acreage, and they trap them. Bulk of what we sell is Nilgai. And so those are actually completely wild animals coming from the coast. And so they go in there and they catch them with net guns, like shooting nets over them, big traps, stuff like that.
So, no shit, really?
So a lot of what we serve.
And that can wind up in the restaurant trade.
Yeah, well, there's some inspection processes since they're not swine. They fall under a different status. And so they aren't as highly regulated. And so there's even a wild game company here that sends an inspector out in the field and they shoot deer, but they, I mean, non-native. So axis, sika, fallow deer, things like that.
When you say sika, you mean like, you're talking like the sika deer, the little elk-like deer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you guys call them sika? A true whitetail is never on your menu.
No,
okay.
No, we never serve whitetail.
Oh.
So these are typically gonna be deer that are, you know, proliferated on a ranch. Now, granted, it's a high fence.
Yep.
But typically very large, and they are trapped. But for the most part, my big thing is diet. So they are living wild. They're not in a pen. They're living wild, and they're eating mostly a wild diet. Now, they're probably hitting a corn feeder here and there. But, I mean, versus any wild deer in the state, it's probably about the same. So I also think that they are invasives. In a way, and it's the best thing that we can do while falling under the parameters of the law.
And you guys don't sell deer coming out of New Zealand?
Never. We don't sell, I mean, for that matter, we don't sell any product, any fresh product that doesn't, I mean, it has to come from Texas. Oh.
That's interesting, man. I had no idea that I was planning on busting your balls.
No, sorry.
But I didn't even get a chance.
Yeah.
Really, so that's what it is. So people, you're getting like a pretty legit wild game experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the taqueria, we're using all nilgai there. So that's a wild animal. All the sausage we do at the brick and mortar is nilgai. And then when we get in a whole carcass, you know, it's, you know, we never know what we're going to get. It's my guy calls me and he's like, "Hey, we got a couple red deer in the trap. Great, bring them."
Oh, that's.
This might be proprietary info, but can you tell me what your cut of fat to how much fat you cut into making your average sausage? I mean, it probably varies here and there.
20 to 25.
20 to 25. Okay.
Feed us.
What? What?
Give me money.
This. I want to provide good information for tonight's audience. So, what are? So you've got hunting background, you've got chef background, and remember earlier we were talking about like pre like back when it was harder to get information than it is now. I feel that there used to be like growing up hunting. We just had like certain ways we cooked everything. And then you later learn that you had like people in the culinary world and chefs and things, and they had their way of doing stuff, but the communication didn't, there wasn't like an exchange of communication. Like if you were a rural person eating wild game, you probably cooked it like how your grandma cooked it, and they probably cooked it how their grandma cooked it. And you didn't have this big exchange between the culinary world, you know, the professional culinary world and rural wild game people. And now there's more freedom, right? I think you'd agree with that. There's a lot more just exchange of ideas. Like, for instance, you know, last time I had dinner at Carl's, we'll talk about what we had last time I had dinner at your house.
The last time you were there, we capitalized on some technology that I had imported from my time in China, where one of my favorite dishes was what the Chinese call huo guo, which translates basically into hot pot. And you'll sit around a table with a big hole in the middle and it'll hold a cauldron of boiling broth with all kinds of spices. And it's a really social thing because everybody's gathered around with chopsticks and dipping in like all manner of fish and meat and eggs and coagulated blood and all manner of mushrooms and aromatics. Yeah, it's like a fondue kind of deal. And so, you know, I was going to have Steve and Giannis paying me a visit. And when you're hosting these jokers at your house for dinner, you don't want to be pulling out like a package of ballpark Franks and slapping them on the grill. Not that you guys wouldn't like ballpark, but I was like, what could I do that would be creative? So we did this menagerie of wild fish and game from all over New Mexico.
We had walleye.
Yep. We had walleye. We had, pronghorn, heart,
turkey,
wild turkey, giblets. There was some elk. We had, you know, just like whatever was in the freezer. And it was a, you know, fun way to spend an evening.
Yeah, like with seasoning packets from China.
Yeah.
Put into the thing. So,
yeah.
Like the point being that there's this exchange now. So if you imagine your position where you've got a foot in the hunting world and you've got a foot in the technical culinary world, what are the misconceptions about wild pigs that you find, like when you talk, like the hunters have their own ideas about like what's edible, not edible, what's good, not good. Where does that contradict what you found from the professional kitchen?
The wild pig specifically?
Sure, man. Or whatever you want to get into.
Well, I think in general, I mean, just the collective consciousness has shifted so much, and you can speak to this a lot. I mean, that's what you do, is communicate food to people that are increasingly way more interested in that part of it. I mean, they're starting to recognize that, you know, dead animal on the ground, you're halfway done with this job. And there's more enjoyment to it. Now, you don't just slap some Italian dressing on it anymore and wrap it in bacon, although you can.
When I was a kid, it was cream of mushroom soup in a crock pot.
Right. But I think people are just, I mean, you just see so much more excitement about it now. And more curiosity. People are willing to try different things, and they're being more adventurous, and they're wanting to get more out of that part of, I mean, all that work that they're going out there to do. And I think with hogs, we experience a lot of myth and people, a lot of misconceptions. You know, like I've been told that, you know, 120 pounds is the biggest hog that you can eat. So, like 119 is just, but 121 is just gut pile material. And that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I've had a 300-pound boar that was amazing. And you're not going to believe that. But, I mean, trust me on this. I mean, and I think that, I mean, my mission is to just get people to eat more pigs. I mean, they're invasive. They're tearing up land. There's people that don't have enough food out there, like this gentleman that's working so hard to feed them. And it's just like, we're shooting piles of pigs and leaving them to lie in a field. And I think that if we can get out there and educate and show people that these pigs can be delicious. I'm not saying they're all stunning. There's some of them that are stinky. I've experienced that.
But so there are stinky pigs. I mean, I've shot pigs that I thought were way better than other pigs I've shot. What do you think is going on with what's a bad pig?
Well, I mean, go back anecdotally to my snare story. You know, stress is a big one. It's like the bigger the pig, the harder it is to bring down, the longer it runs, the more it adrenalizes, the less lactic acids build up in the muscles, the tougher it can be, the gamier it can be. Diet is a huge one. We kill pigs in South Texas, which aren't nearly as good as the pigs that we kill out in Lockhart or maybe in the, you know, East Texas, where you have four kinds of oaks, or, you know, in places where there's lots of pecans and oaks. Diet forms a big part of that equation. But I think that just convincing people to give them more of a chance, try some different cuts, try the ribs, try more slow cooking on them, you know, like really break them down, get adventurous. I mean, or maybe not adventurous is the right word. I think a lot of times, you know, when you see a recipe that's like this, you know, 9 hours sous vide project, and it's got a lingonberry glaze on it, and you need a chiffonade of fresh mint, and you need to find galangal to finely mince and put on top, you're going to be like, there's no way. But if I was like, why don't you make a sloppy joe out of it? You're going to do that, and it's going to be amazing. And I think that's the way that you communicate to people, is you put it in a context that, you know, they first off can recognize how to make it, and second, recognize how it should taste.
Is it true? I've heard it so many times, I don't know if it's true, like that people say that a wet sow is like the best wild pig to eat. Because it's, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean,
a pregnant sow. That it hasn't had them yet, but that's sure the one you want to eat. Or is that just like another myth, or is that true?
No, I was guiding a guy the other day in a blind, and we were at one of our hunting schools, and two sows walked out. One was pregnant, one was nursing, and I was like, shoot the pregnant one.
Because you think it's better meat?
Yeah, the fat's staying in instead of going out. So you just, and fat is what you want in hogs. It's just, it's all about fat.
Can you, what's up with age in hog meat? Is it not worth it?
Well, we're in a warm climate, so I mean, if you have the, you know, the walk-in cooler that's got a lot of moving air in it, then by all means, you can try it. I think that it's risky. It can be done, but I think that in a really cold and dry environment, you're looking at up to about 10 days with a hog. But like, if you're talking about like aging, like people are doing with beef, you know, pushing 60 days, stuff like that, and people are doing with pork, domestic pork as well right now, I think that you'd be better choosing a different battle.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think let them get through rigor mortis and then cut them at your earliest convenience.
So you're like the hog proselytizer. But let me ask you this, though. This is a question I always ask people that, like, so you guys enjoy this you enjoy this resource, and you can have as much of it as you want, and the animal becomes, like, really interwoven into the culture. So, like the pig has become, you know, almost, like, synonymous with Texas hunting culture. But the reason it's like gloves off on pigs is because they're non-native and problematic. I always ask pig hunters this. It's like, if I gave you a magic wand, right? And I said, if you shake this wand, it'll be done. The pigs will be gone. So not that. You're not that far. You wouldn't shake the wand.
No. I wouldn't. I'd get in trouble with my friends at Parks and Wildlife too, but I'm sorry, I can't shake that wand. I mean, the control, yes. I mean, we have them in East Austin now, like in the city limits. They're a rampant problem, and I have friends that are farmers, and they want to shake that wand too, and I think that we need to find...
So you do feel that there are people in Texas who would shake the magic wand?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. You a shaker or not shaker, Carl? Because you have an obligation to American wildlife. You'd have to shake it.
Yeah, I would.
Really?
Yep.
You got to find another door out of here to...
But, you know, I can understand the sentiment behind not wanting to shake it. I mean, I can understand how a species that you have interacted with and that's fed your family and that you've spent all this time learning about and... you know, breaking them down and cooking them. Like, over time, I can completely understand and appreciate the kind of relationship that people would feel towards that animal. And so I'm not dismissing that, but from an ecological perspective, I would absolutely shake that wand.
Really? Would you shake it? I'm staying out of it. Would you shake the wand?
I feel like I'm supposed to say yes, but I probably wouldn't.
You probably wouldn't shake the wand.
No.
You know, we were in Chesapeake Bay in the East Shore, and there's a fish there, a snakehead. Do you guys have snakeheads here, like a non-native fish? And at first, the snakeheads hit the water, and everyone's like, oh my God, snakeheads are going to kill us all. It's the end of the world, snakeheads. Now you see dudes with, like, snakehead decals. And it wasn't even that many years. Snakehead decals in their truck window, where we have this way, like, I think that humans are so pragmatic, where we have this thing, it's like, here it is, it's good to eat, you know, when life gives you lemons, right? You make lemonade, and we kind of are like really quick to adopt stuff, the non-native stuff. There are, like, most of the places we hunt turkeys aren't native there.
That's right. We probably wouldn't shake the stick on them, would we?
No, I wouldn't shake the stick on those poor birds.
Yeah, but there's an important... differentiation.
They're
here,
not
right?
Deleterious. I wanted to touch real quick. We were talking about chap ass like an episode or two ago. You guys are familiar with chap ass. Like, what's another word for it? Chafing.
Monkey butt.
Swamp ass. We got, man, like, it was the number one, probably the number, no, of the things that we get written about, Giannis's heart. It's probably number one. People who are...
still number one.
No, long-term.
Long-term.
People diagnosing Giannis's heart.
Mm-hmm.
We had a question not long ago where someone was... It was at a lot. It was in Sacramento. A guy was asking. He was like, man, I want to ask this, but I don't want my wife to know. And he wrote in. And he was saying that if you gut a rabbit, that after gutting the rabbit, why does one's flatulence smell exactly like the gutted rabbit? That got an enormous amount of thing. And one guy wrote in and he described a phenomenon called deja poo, which is like, this guy worked in like for a coroner or something. And he was saying that he thinks there are that there's like volatile fatty acids. When you smell something foul, there's volatile fatty acids and that somehow they get in your nose hairs. This is just, and he was saying that you get, when you smell an offensive smell later, it can carry a trace of that, giving one the sense of deja vu, which I don't suffer from. But on the champ ass thing, two really interesting pieces of feedback. One, there's all these products that people have that solve champ ass. But one guy was saying, he was with a guy one time that got champ ass so bad that he couldn't walk, it was that bad, and he took his sandwich apart and took a piece of bologna out of it and laid that piece of bologna between the cheeks in order to hike out. Another guy writes in that the way to cure it, this is the most interesting concoction. He's like, oh, bro, I know all about this. He likes to mix Neosporin with Orajel. Like the tooth numbing agent. And he's like, that's how you take care of that problem. Which I love. But I want to move on. I just wanted to touch on that. I want to move on to another subject that this came in. And I already know my answer because I've done this before. But it's a guy. It goes something like, I didn't write down as many details as I should have, but there's a guy and he's got a girlfriend and they live with a roommate. His girlfriend eats wild game. The roommate won't eat wild game. Just like eats meat, won't eat wild game. What are the ethics of just lying and giving them the wild game?
My late mom did it to my grandmother all the time.
And he's ethical? What do you guys think about it?
Go for it.
You're totally fine.
Totally fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got nothing against it. I don't feel like I'm doing them a disservice or lying to them. They're going to come out of it, you know, something bad's going to happen. They're going to have a negative effect, you know, from eating the wild game I tricked them to eat.
But, the teacher who cut in the kangaroo.
Yeah, like the guy that did we talked about the guy that was serving kangaroo meat to school kids without telling them. But that guy lost his job.
Yeah, that's a little different than just tricking your roommate. A little bit.
Would you pull a fast one, Carl?
I would say it depends, honestly. So, I mean, on the one hand, I mean, we've all had roommates, right? And if your roommate is, like, eating some food that you've provided, to some extent, it's like, you're lucky that you're getting some food from me, right? Yeah. So there's that dynamic. And then I think there's, like, an important distinction to Yanni's point about whether there's potential for the food to have, like, a negative outcome. So I'm sitting here thinking about, like, the example of all these people that have been exposed to CWD-positive deer meat, for example. Yeah. So I would say if you're talking about like sharing a roast from a deer that you know is healthy, that's one thing. If you're sharing some kind of funky like brain dish, and you're like, hey, try this out. And then after the fact, you're telling them what it is. Or if you're sharing meat from an animal that you're not sure, like CWD status, I'd say there's kind of some gray area there. But if it comes to just like you're making some food and they want to eat it, but it's contingent upon whether or not it's wild game, I'd be like, have it. Tell me if you like it.
And I wouldn't
lose sleep. Yeah, I think I would.
Would you give them house cat meat? Do you know what I'm saying? That's why it becomes really tricky, because how do you draw the line?
The reason that we're all doing this, I believe, is because we're hoping that it results in like the lights getting turned off and they're like, oh my God, that was deer.
That was freaking
awesome. Please, I'd like to eat some more now, right? Like that's why you're going through that process.
So I kind of did this the other day.
Not because you're like, ha ha, meow, meow.
Not the cat thing. Not the cat
thing. Like, where is that cat anyway?
But so I've been accumulating I've been accumulating ungulate tongues for the last few years in my freezer. And I got to the point where I had a moose tongue, a deer tongue, a pronghorn tongue, all in a bag. I thaw these things out. I cook them for 8 hours in the slow cooker. And my mom is living with us right now. My mom comes out in the kitchen. I've got these things on the cutting board. She's like, what do you have there? I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm making a dish here. Like, let me make the dish. She's like, are those mushrooms of some kind? I'm like, no. Like, let me do this. She's like, what is it? Is that? I say, it's food I'm cooking. Hold back. Let me do this. And I end up making tacos de lengua with these tongues. And they turned out fantastic. And I serve them to my mom. I serve them to my wife. Serve them to my daughter. My mom is like, these are the best tacos I've had in years. These are the best. And then a couple hours later, my wife and my mom are standing in the kitchen. My mom's like, what the hell were those things you were cutting up the other day in the kitchen, yesterday in the kitchen? And, I was acting kind of shifty, and my wife's like, what's she talking about? And I said, well, that was what we had for tacos. And then my wife gets real nervous, right? She's like, what are you feeding us? So I say, those were tongues. And my mom's like, oh, no. And I'm like, but you said those were the best tacos you'd had in years. So that's an example where it's like, I know that meat is totally safe. I know there's no good reason. And my mom is very pragmatic. And she's the one who's always told me, if you're going to kill it, eat it. That was like the golden rule. So I'm asking my mom then, would you rather that I left this tongue in the woods with the gut pile when I brought out all that meat, or would you rather put it to use to make the best tacos you've had in a couple years?
Yeah, you're helping me clarify my perspective on it. My perspective on it is this, because I've done exactly that. I gave my mother-in-law tongue, like cold, chilled, cubed, cured tongue in a salad, and she later said, that ham was so good.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. It wasn't like, I don't feel the need to tell people what it is they're eating. But if I know that someone is like, I don't eat X.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ethical to trick them into eating what they say they don't want to eat. I don't know that it's your business to tell them that their reason is right and wrong.
I agree with that.
That's where I draw the line a little bit.
Yeah.
Because if someone had like a religious dietary prohibition, I wouldn't then feed them.
Yes.
And be like, nah.
Yeah. No, that's messed up for
you
sure.
You know?
For sure.
Do you got any perspective to offer on this?
I've done it before.
You've done?
Diver ducks.
Diver ducks?
I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, that if it was like a person who eats meat and all, but they're like, oh, I don't eat diver duck, I would totally screw with that person. Because that's not
I
like,
made gumbo, and I don't even think they knew it was duck. They were just like, oh. They knew it was something wild, but they were like, oh, well, it's wild game, but it's good. I think they thought it was venison.
And eating is fine. Everybody's fine.
I don't remember if I told them or not. I mean, we carried on with the night. Nobody was like, what was that meat?
Everybody's fine.
Yeah.
This is somewhat related, and I'll explain where it gets related in a minute here. But there's another thing. I've been like saving up emails from people that are all kind of the same thing, where this is going to not seem related, but trust me, I'm going to make it related. They all seem like not the same thing. Or I'm sorry, saving up emails of people asking the same thing would be like, if you kill an animal and it's been injured, or oftentimes it'll be like, I found an animal with an infection, or it had a broadhead in it and had an injury, is it safe to eat? Enough work. We even had a guy write in, and we talked about this, and then he wrote back in to clarify his point, but he one time hung a deer up, some kind of, I can't remember what the hell it was, a raccoon or something, gnawed on the muzzle of the deer, and then he was like, is it safe to eat? So, like, where do you personally draw the line at which something that's messed up is not safe to eat?
I mean, we've pulled, bullets, shotgun pellets, stuff out of hogs. I've seen, rice breasts in ducks. The rice breast is trash. It's too much. It's a pretty general infection, but I think
that's just all kinds of cysts, the meat's packed with cysts.
I mean, I think that like if it's a pretty generalized acute injury and you can cut it out, then it's fine. I mean, considering that you also just shot 150 grams of lead through it, it's got another injury now. And there's dirt and blood and bone and everything, and you're going to just happily kind of cut around all that and all that hydrostatic trauma and kind of make that a palatable looking piece of meat. I think that a small injury that doesn't indicate like anything worse, if the animal wasn't acting like super sick, then I think it's okay. But you might know better though.
I have discarded entire legs because of injuries and infections. I one time had a turkey that must have, its whole breast was shot because it had must have pitched into a tree but impaled itself with a stick, and it was just horrible, and ditched that. So I'm not just eating sacks of pus out of stuff. But it is a thing that like comes into people's minds. But I can never think of I've never thought of a thing where you would have like an injury would somehow make something inedible and get you sick. When we had the bear that gave me and Giannis trichinosis, I had to send some to the CDC for testing, but I still had most of the bear meat, and I smoked one of the bear hams. So we got sick off it, and we knew that this thing had 868 larvae per gram. And my brother, I had signed up to bring a dish to pass to my brother's rehearsal dinner for his wedding. And I was like, I'm going to bring this smoked bear ham. And then I'm like, man, the smoked bear ham I was going to bring. Turns out, and I told him about what was wrong with it. And he said, well, don't tell anybody. And I thought, I was like, I can't not tell him. I have to tell him. He said, then if you're going to tell him, don't bring it. Because the minute you tell him that this has all this larva living in it, you're going to make all the other food suspect. Like, no one's going to trust anything you say at that point. So in that case, I again was incapable of doing like the lie, even though I cooked it to 160 degrees.
You did the right thing.
You think so?
I do.
I feel in some way like I chickened out.
Zombie.
Give me a, oh, what's going on?
That's zombie deer.
Oh, the zombie deer. Do you want to get into the zombie deer? Okay. Honestly, a quick poll.
Yeah,
quick poll.
Actually.
Let's do a quick poll. Now that we know, okay, for a while it came out, for a while everyone was all hot and bothered about this piece of research that some researchers in Canada had taken macaw monkeys.
Macaque.
That's how you say that word? Macaque? Yeah. Macaque, yeah. Monkeys. So some researchers in Canada said, oh, we gave some macaque monkeys CWD infected meat, and the monkeys contracted CWD. Turns out that's not true. They didn't publish it. It wasn't peer reviewed. When the National Institute for Health looked into it, that didn't happen. How you mess that up, I'll never understand. But wasn't true. But it really got people excited. Another case where someone was doing a fundraiser, I think it was at a fire barn, like a fire department fundraiser. They accidentally served CWD infected meat to 200 people. This is 7 years ago, I believe, roughly 7 years ago. 87 of those people have agreed to be monitored. They've been monitoring them since. Nothing yet. There's no known case. There's no known case of a human contracting CWD. So the two things. 2 points. But there are, man, this is such a sticky subject. There are people who remain, like I imagine most of you, people who remain like, I definitely want to know more. I'm not going to get hysterical, but the scientific community, I think we should be investing money to learn more about possible transmission. Then there are people who have already made up their mind that there's no risk whatsoever. If I want to go to my buddy Doug's place, he lives in the CWD area, and I want to get meat from like 10 CWD positive deer, and I want to gouge out some of their spinal cord, and I want to take some of their glands, and I want to make burger out of it. And then I'm going to make patties, and when I meet a total CWD denier, I will cook that burger, and I will lay it on his plate. And if that son of a bitch eats that burger, I'll be like, now let's talk.
I like that.
If they hesitate, then I'm like, we're in the same boat, brother. Like, that burger makes me nervous. So never mind the burger and never mind a blend of 20 whatever. If you had it, you get a deer, it comes back CWD positive. Giannis, would you eat the deer?
Not eating it.
Not eating it.
No.
No.
Not gonna eat it.
I don't know. It would sit in my freezer for a long time.
Yeah. That's a good point.
No, it's not. No. Don't eat it.
You're not eating it.
No. That's the answer. The answer is no. Don't eat it.
It sucks.
But you have to toss that deer.
I feel that, like, I'm going middle ground.
No.
No. There's no way I would give it. I would not give it to my kids. But I would have a very, very difficult time discarding it. Maybe I'll just keep it in my freezer and look at it.
Just serve your mother-in-law.
Yeah. I'm like, and here's your deer meat. No, no, that's horrible.
Yeah, we wouldn't do that, Cindy. We love you.
No, I wouldn't do it. It is scary. There's a couple newsy things I wanted to get into, but like a couple hot button issues, but this is going to be the one. It terrifies me. I don't worry about the resource impact. Meaning, I don't worry about, I'm not like keeping up at night about reduced deer numbers from CWD. I'm not worried about, it's terrible that it happens. Like, here's what I'm saying. If somehow some omniscient, all-knowing being could come and say, CWD cannot and will not be transmitted to humans. I would never give it another thought. I would kind of lose interest in it. Like, there are people who are like, well, what's it going to mean for deer numbers? Like, I just feel like it'll just join the list of all the other damn diseases that sweep through deer herds now and then and wipe them out. And then they come back. But the food, the idea of hunters getting sick from venison is just an upsetting, gut-wrenching thought. The coolest thing in the world becoming somehow not cool is a heartbreaker. And I don't at this point, I don't know that anyone can really say anything more than that.
I would add that it's happened. It's happened. We haven't had the confirmed case of a person contracting CWD from eating an infected deer.
No, and thousands of people have eaten it.
But we have had already the culture around deer being compromised by the existence of that disease. And I'm speaking about this from the standpoint of a guy who was in grad school in Madison, Wisconsin, shortly after it was discovered in Southwest Wisconsin, and watching the way just my own circle of friends over the course of the last 10 years, the way that our conversations have evolved around deer hunting. In that part of the state, those impacts are already occurring.
Yeah,
it's changed. You know, if you're thinking about where do I want to spend my precious time away from work when I've got a couple weeks of leave time to spend over the course of the year, and I want to fill my freezer, do I want to travel and hunt in an area that I know and love and have hunted a lot but has CWD, or do I want to maybe try to find another spot to hunt? And it makes it real hard to want to go back and hunt in an area where you might, you know, you've got a coin toss as to whether or not the deer you kill is going to be able to be something you can feed to your family. So if you look at all the culture around the activity, the land ownership, it's just it's a very real, very sad state of affairs. And even if we don't have that example of a person getting sick from it, just the risk of that, I think, is already compromising the hunting culture, and it frustrates.
It's entered your head.
Oh, it's entered my head, and to see the inaction that has persisted frustrates the hell out of me, man.
I think now exactly half the states, 26 states. Texas not, right?
You know how many states we have, right?
Well, you do have it now.
It's in smaller areas.
26 is a little more than it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But I mean, it's like, I feel like it was like 24 and then two more this year, right? Yeah. Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And Texas has something.
There's a small quarantine area in Bandera, south of San Antonio, and then in West Texas.
66 confirmed in Texas? You know, everyone in here who would eat a CWD positive deer.
Oh, that's a good one.
Say, yep.
Yep.
Hell no.
Well, no.
There's the five. Game. There's five in here that would eat your burger.
No, you got, okay. Not my crazy spinal cord burger, but just like my lymph node burger. I'm honestly curious. So if you would, just a nice, calm, yup. Like if you would eat a CWD positive deer. Okay, if you would not. Well, you're not doing the nice, clean yup. Oh, I hate it. I don't want to, like, I don't, man.
Parliamentary procedure.
What's that?
Parliamentary procedure.
What's that mean?
I'm not familiar with the parliamentary procedure.
Oh, parliamentary procedure. Oh, you know, real quick, did you know that I was reading a guy wrote in saying that eradicating pigs is part of the EU's New World Order domination plan?
No, I did not hear that.
Dude, it was he laid out a very fascinating case. We're going to move real quick. So now, how are we going to pick our person?
Oh, we didn't pre-plan that. Yeah.
We messed it up. We're going to play seeing through the bullshit.
Yeah.
Where someone has to come up and they're going to be presented with two lies and a single truth.
Ryan, can you help us
Ryan,
out?
Can you pick us one? Just grab someone. So we normally like select something early. So we're going to play and... but first, I have a correction to make. We played this not long ago. We played this not long ago, and we accidentally did three lies because we're talking about a famous, like the deadliest tiger, the deadliest animal ever was the Champawat tigress, and it was a tiger who had messed up teeth. Some people believe that she had been shot by a poacher, busted her teeth. The tiger then dedicated itself to killing humans and eating humans. And this is no joke. It's probably more, but attributed that this single tigress killed 356 people. And it was killed by a... I screwed up, and we got a lot of heat for this. I screwed up and said that the guy that killed it, Jim Corbett, I said that he was American, but the dude was British, and people were pissed. It was like when I said Sam Houston died at the Alamo. People were worked up. So that's my correction. Corbett was British. Now, if you win,
Come on out.
You just get it. Not if you win. What's that? Go ahead.
Our contestant is here. What's your name?
Here.
Jay,
nice to meet you, man.
Nice to meet you.
Grab a seat. Here, I'll spin you so you can look right in the eye of the storytellers.
Okay, we're going to tell you things that are, there's one true thing hiding within this.
All right.
You want, what you want first?
Truth.
Okay. Are you familiar with youth? Are you familiar with youth hunting seasons?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And you are aware of the fact that now and then a doe, a female whitetail, will grow antlers.
Yes.
Okay. Tennessee's youth hunting season. A new youth hunting season record was set in Tennessee by an antlered doe. The individual who was holding the record prior to this kill has actually contested the new entry because it's not a buck. Carl.
Okay, so I have a story that weaves together bears and national forests, and it goes like this. In the 1980s, a narcotics officer turned drug runner by the name of Andrew Thornton was traveling over the Chattahoochee National Forest in a small airplane containing 40 plastic containers of blow. Coke, the white stuff. He threw the containers out of the plane, donned his parachute, leaving the plane unattended, and en route to the ground, unfortunately, became tangled in his own parachute, plummeting to his death. Agents, when they went in to recover the drugs and his body, expecting to find $15 million worth of cocaine, some 40 kilos, instead came upon a very dead black bear. The black bear had died of the single most impressive drug overdose in the history of wildlife ecology, stuffed to the brim with the white stuff. A necropsy revealed the bear had died from a combination of cerebral hemorrhaging, respiratory failure, hyperthermia, renal failure, heart failure, and a stroke. That bear is now stuffed and on display at the Kentucky Fun Mall in North Lexington, where he dons the moniker Pablo Escobar.
Okay, Danielle. Well told.
Danielle.
All right, so are you familiar with the Lone Star Tick?
Not really.
Okay.
You don't know about the Lone Star Tick in the Lone Star State?
No. I'm not.
So we have...
We gotta find somebody else. Sorry, man.
Just kidding. Real, bro.
So we have a tick that carries, I think it's called an alpha-gal carbohydrate. And so when it bites and infects a human, goes into the bloodstream, we produce a whole bunch of antibodies and basically have an allergic reaction so severe that we can no longer eat red meat. So beef, lamb... So I'm just explaining what the tick is.
We're just getting him up to speed.
Got this tick, and recently down in South Texas, they stumbled upon several coyotes that were really scrawny, and they started trying to figure out what was wrong with these coyotes, and they tested them, and they contracted this disease from Lone Star Tick because they can't eat meat.
Now, if you need help from the crowd, I can go to each one of the storytellers and stand behind them, and the crowd can yell the loudest for who they think is the truth, if you need that help.
Or you a quick review?
Yeah.
A little review.
Okay, you have the story of the new youth season whitetail deer record. You have the story of Pablo Escobar. And you have the story of that the meat allergen that can be caused, that humans can contract from the Lone Star Tick has been proven to be able to afflict coyotes and make them intolerant of meat, which leads to their emaciation and eventual death.
And they all live in Frisco. You want help? You want help from the crowd? Okay.
Let me real quick. Now, so what we have is some Fury HD 5000 binoculars from our friends at Vortex. We needed a present. So it's seeing through the bullshit. We needed a present.
Yep.
And you get laser range finding binoculars.
All right.
Real expensive. Real nice.
No pressure.
Lifetime warrant, lifetime thing. You could, if they burn up in a house fire, they'll give you new ones.
All right.
As long as you got some chunk of plastic to send in.
Okay, is it Danielle's? Let's ask the crowd. Danielle's story about the veggie coyotes?
What? By bullshit, do you mean true or not true? That's a lie. Okay.
Carl's story about Pablo Escobar. Steve's story about the female buck that's now the state youth record in Tennessee. Oh, no.
That's hard. I really was leaning towards that one. I really was.
You were leaning toward the youth season?
Oh, I was.
Well, that's if you want to win.
But it's my fellow Texans, and I'm going to go the Texan way. And I'm gonna go with Pablo Escobar.
You got it!
Thanks for playing.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Have a good night. And then thank you all very much. We love every one of you. You guys are the best.